Welcome to the Awe and Wonder podcast. We're in season 5, talking about vision and assistive technology in AAC. I'm Sarah Kinsella.
And I'm Brenda Del Monte.
And today we're joined by Luis Perez. Luis is the Disability and Digital Inclusion Lead for CAS. And Luis promotes the creation, delivery, and use of high-quality, accessible educational materials and technologies to support equitable learning opportunities for all students. So we're so excited to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's a really exciting opportunity to share a little bit about my experiences in education and with technology. So as the Disability and Digital Inclusion Lead at CAS, I'm part of a group, small but mighty group at CAS that focuses on post-secondary and workforce development. So making sure that all students have access to all the career opportunities that are available out there. And then I'm also part of our National Center on Accessible Educational Materials, which provides technical assistance with federal funding from the U.S. government, the Department of or the Office of Special Education Programs, to create systems that result in the timely delivery of high-quality accessible educational materials and technologies. And I come to this work from a personal perspective as someone who's really benefited from, accessible environments, accessible content has been key in my journey through education. I was actually diagnosed with a visual impairment late in life, but it is a visual impairment called retinitis pigmentosa that kind of results in you losing your vision from the outside in. So some people call it tunnel vision. And there is a possibility that I would lose my vision completely during my lifetime. But I was diagnosed with this visual impairment when I had gone through high school and college and then ended up in graduate school. So I was starting my master's program when I was diagnosed with this visual impairment after having a series of car accidents. Oh. And so that's when I decided to go to the eye doctor. And because of where the car accidents have happened, they were looking at my peripheral vision, and that's when we discovered that I had retinitis pigmentosa. And so that was a difficult time because being in a graduate program is really challenging as it is. There's a lot of reading. There's a lot of content to go through. And so all of a sudden, I had to make an adjustment in my life and figure out, how to make do. And so I was fortunate enough that I was working at a computer lab at our university as one of those work study jobs. And they had just acquired the first set of Mac computers that came with a built-in screen reader. and as I was setting up on one of these computers, I found this setting, right? And I was like, hey, what does this do? And I turned it on and the computer started speaking to me. And that changed my life in an instant. And it wasn't necessarily like, oh, the voice is, super high quality. Obviously, they've improved over time.
Sure.
But it was really the message, right? It was the message of hope that, there are really smart people out there and they're working on these technologies that are going to make my life better.
Yeah.
And that are going to allow me to continue to be a graduate student. And then when I'm done here, they're going to allow me to continue to be employed.
Mm-hmm.
And so ever since then, I've been really hooked on assistive technology because I saw the impact that it had in my own life. And so I wanted to see that impact in other people's lives, right? So that they have access to all of the opportunities that they want to enjoy, whether it's studying, learning, employment, their hobbies, right? So I use assistive technology in my hobby, which is a unique one for somebody with a visual impairment. I'm a wildlife photographer. So I didn't just choose photography. I chose the most challenging type of photography. But again, that's only possible because of accessibility. So that passion really is what drives my work in terms of bringing people the tools that then empower them to do what they want to do.
That's so interesting that you just stumbled across that assistive technology the first time. When I was looking for your bio online, I saw some photography mentioned. I'm curious, what kind of assistive technology do you use for that?
So there are a number of things. Well, first of all, accessibility in terms of the environment is really important. So that means that the parks that I'm visiting need to be accessible, right? Mm-hmm. I am a white cane user. I don't use a guide dog yet, but that may be in my future. But I do use a white cane, and navigating the environment without peripheral vision can be a challenge. So, whether that's ramps or accessible boardwalks where I can be in nature but still be within a safe environment where I'm not going to trip and hurt myself. Although sometimes I go off-road a little bit because I like to challenge myself. But the accessibility of the environment is really important. The research that I do, a lot of wildlife photography is doing research. So it's knowing where the animals are going to be and what habitat. And so I use apps that have accessibility built into them so that, they can describe the different types of animals that I might encounter. And some of them have sound bird calls that I can listen to. And so for a lot of the birds that I'm photographing, I hear them before I see them. And in some cases, I never see them when I take a photo. I let my camera do most of the work. Because the cameras today are really sophisticated and have amazing auto focus systems. So a lot of times it's just a matter of I just take the photo and then later on I review them on my iPad and make some selections. But also like my iPhone has image detection capabilities where it can tell me in many cases what kind of bird it is. For a long, there was one time when the iPhone first got these capabilities. I took a photo of a flower, close up of the flower, and I couldn't tell what it was. And in my iPhone, I was able to select the image, and it actually told me what type of flower it was.
It's so amazing.
So with things like machine learning and AI, we're able to do amazing things. And some of the cameras now have a built-in screen reader. So if you use a Sony camera, which is the type of camera that I use, they now actually are, as far as I know, the only system that has a built-in screen reader. And it may be that, not everybody uses that screen reader, right? Most of the people that are doing photography probably have some vision left, some useful vision. But again, it's the message that's important. The message is we've thought about the whole range of users that may pick up this camera.
Yes.
And it may be that they just needed to navigate the menus while they're out there. And with photography, we're often in really harsh lighting conditions. So kind of going back to, so not just accessibility, it's universal design. It may be that just by turning on the screen reader when you can't see the screen because of just glare and harsh lighting, that could be helpful to you even if you don't have a visual impairment.
Right. Another part of that message is we've thought about you, and you don't have to go buy something or find something additional because you have low vision or whatever it is. We've thought about you ahead of time, and it's available.
But it does bring up a point where there's a lot of people listening going, wait a minute, I thought he said that he is, blind, or he's, I feel like the word blind has its own, everyone has its own, their own idea about what that actually means. And a lot of people assume blind means no vision. So, what do you, how do you describe the difference, low vision versus blind versus what do you believe in the paperwork and what do you just go ahead and try because you don't know what kids can see? Like, where are we at with the terminology around it and how limiting can that be?
Yeah, that's been an evolution for me. First of all, it took me a long time to come to terms with my disability. So I want to be upfront about that. Because again, as someone who had grown up, quote unquote, sighted, or at least being able to pass as sighted, it did came take some time for me to kind of come to terms with the emotional aspects of, being diagnosed with a disability and identifying as someone who has a disability. And I use the term blind sometimes because not to describe like the way my eyes work, but because I'm part of a community. I'm part of a big group of people in the United States who for years have been, seeking their civil rights. They're seeking legal protections. And so I consider myself part of that community. And then sometimes I use the term visual impairment because that more accurately describes like the physical condition that I have in the sense that I still have some functional eyesight, even though it's very limited. I have about 8 or 9 degrees of central vision. So it's very easy to disappear in my world. You just move a few inches to the side and you're gone. But I think the takeaway here is, in the autism community, they say you've met one person with autism, you met one person with autism. And so I would love for people to just take that same approach to people with visual impairments. There's a whole range from, almost completely blind or blind, where you may just have light perception, you may only be able to see certain movements. To, in my case, if I'm looking straight ahead, my vision is fairly good with correction, right? With eyeglasses. But you move a few inches to the side and you've disappeared. And then there's color issues, right? Your visual acuity is fine, but if you're looking at an interface and we tell you to click the green button or, select the red button, not everybody can do that. There are some people who can't see red or green. And there's people that have central vision and they don't have, or they have peripheral vision, they don't have central vision. So again, we need to consider the whole spectrum of different challenges that people bring to the experience. And that was difficult for me. Once I discovered that I had a visual impairment and I sought my accommodations and I got my accommodations, guess what kind of accommodation I got? Large print. What's the
And that's it.
worst kind of accommodation for somebody with my kind of visual impairment?
Sure.
Large print, because then more of the print is outside of my central vision. But
Sure.
again, that's because somebody was just checking a box and
Yeah.
saying, this is the accommodation we've done for students with visual impairments before, instead of really sitting down and thinking about what are the specific challenges that you have, and then let's come up with the strategies, the tools, and so on that would address those specific challenges.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your vision may change over time. Does it also change within the day? And so maybe the tools you use are different throughout the day?
Absolutely. It changes because when you don't have peripheral vision, you do a lot of scanning, and that tires out the muscles in your eyes. So if you get me at 8 o'clock, I may be able to do more reading of actual print. And if you get me at 8 o'clock in the morning, if you get me at 8 o'clock at night, you're probably going to, I'm probably going to be reading more, or I'm going to be using other supports. Like I may make the text bigger, but it can even change within a week. Between Monday, I'm fresh, I'm coming off a weekend, to Friday, I've been looking at a screen quite a bit during the week. And what we do know is that with my visual impairment, it could change over your lifetime in reaction to hormonal changes. So when you turn 40, when you turn 50, there are big changes in your body. I'm realizing that now, not just with vision, but with lots of other things. So it's very variable, is what I'm saying. And so that's why I have to have a toolkit. And then choose tools as needed. Sometimes it may be making the text bigger or switching to a reading view. I love the reading view on my devices, where it just removes all the ads and it shows me just the text, and I can make it bigger and choose a better font, to a full-blown screen reader. So I use all of them.
So you were, if I remember right, when we were talking, you were going to grad school to be like an ambassador. Is that right?
That is correct.
Did you finish that, or did you change your major? And because I know that you mentioned that you somehow got assigned a mentor who also kind of helped you on the way.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that shift from being an ambassador to what you're doing now.
So what happened is, my bachelor's degree is in political science and with a focus on international relations. So basically, I was preparing to be a foreign service officer. So not an ambassador, but just to work for the Foreign Service, which eventually you do have the opportunity to become
Oh, got you.
an ambassador, a consul somewhere that handles visas and things like that. Basically, you work for the State Department. And so I also have a master's in that area of international relations. But then, as you know, life gets in the way sometimes and it throws little curveballs at you. And so that's when I was diagnosed with my visual impairment. So it really changed the trajectory of my life, not only personally, but in terms of my career. I wanted to be in an area where I could make a difference, and I could use my experiences to benefit others. And so education, technology, instructional technology, and assistive technology, that's how I ended up here.
And tell us a little bit about your mentor.
And so when I was first diagnosed, in terms of like the medical profession, that's an area where we could definitely improve because when I was first given the news, it was basically, you're going to lose your vision. Oh, well. Have
Next. Yeah, have a nice day.
a nice day now that we've given you that news. And so that was part of the struggle, was like not knowing what's next, the uncertainty, like, what am I going to be able to do for a living, to make a living, to support my family? Fortunately, the National Federation of the Blind, as I was doing research and reaching out to different groups, they have a mentor program. And so I met someone through the NFB, and they became my mentor. And they're the person, I'm going to protect their privacy. I'm not going to say their name, but they introduced me to the world of web accessibility. And by introduce, I don't mean introduce me to like what web accessibility is. He introduced me to the people that are doing web accessibility. And
The
so
creep.
it allowed me to tap into what I call human capital, which is it's really important when you're trying to break into a new field to meet people that are doing that work already, that can be role models. And that person himself shows me like what it is like to be a successful person with a visual impairment. Because they head accessibility at a major technology company, right? So to me, that's always been like, this is who I want to be when I grow up. I'll never grow up. You shouldn't ever grow up.
Well, what their story brings up two points in my head. One is I think parents of children with that receive that diagnosis for their children experience some of what you're saying, like, oh, it looks like your child may be legally blind, or it looks like your child has really low vision or CVI, but we don't know what it, they can process. They're throwing out some vocabulary, and then it's have a nice day. And parents don't even know. I mean, they're like, I don't know anything about this community. I can't imagine any of this. And it's such a culture shock and a isolating kind of experience when the diagnosis is coming through, not just vision, by the way, any diagnosis, but in this case, vision, it's like, I now what do I do? And now what are they going to be able to do? And so I feel like that a lot of parents can relate to that. Did your family have any kind of reaction to this news?
That was a difficult thing for me. In fact, it still is. Disability is not something that is spoken about a lot in my culture. When it is, it's still, I should also preface this by saying I was born in a different country. I came to the United States as a teenager, so I'm actually a multilingual learner. I learned English here. But anyway, back home, there's still sort of a charity model of disability, a medical model, if you will. It's not necessarily the social model where we think about, disability. It's not just like what's happening with your body. It's also your identity, and it's the way that you look at the world. It's the way that you interact with the world. So it's difficult for me sometimes when I go back home. To like even take my white cane out because it changes the people that the way that people approach me and the way that they make assumptions about me. That happens anywhere, right? But I find that, and it may just be me, but I find that it happens even more when I go back home. So it's still a subject that I'm working through. There's also like starting to religion as well, like no matter how much I tell my family, they cannot pray this away. I mean, prayer is great, and if it works for you, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying that like it's just one way of looking at things, and I still sometimes I feel like I don't have the energy for some of those conversations, so.
That brings us to a question we wanted to ask you about myths. You were talking about assumptions And what are some myths about people with low vision that you think should be addressed?
Well, I think the first one I mentioned, right? Like get to know the person, get to know the range of different visual impairments that are out there. The other myth I would say is like you can't always simulate this. I've seen lots of experiences where we put goggles on people and we try to expose them to these experiences, but then they leave that experience with the misconception of what it's like to be a person with a visual impairment. The fact is, you're only experiencing it for like 15 minutes. I get to experience it all day and the rest of my life. But also, like, I've developed strategies. I've learned strategies over my lifetime that in 15 minutes you may not be able to master. So I often see that when people try to use a screen reader to test a website, and they're like, oh my goodness, this is so difficult and it takes so long. But as a person who uses a screen reader all the time, I've developed shortcuts. And so I can be very efficient in navigating using the heading structure, for instance, or using the landmarks that can be coded into a website. So again, I would just warn against the use of those simulations without some sort of debrief afterwards where we put them in the right context, right? Like this is only one aspect. Like the way that your eyes work is only one aspect of who you are. There's a lot more to it than that. So I would caution, I would say exercise caution in that area.
The things that we run across in with vision and AAC is if it was a child that was the visual impairment was the only known disability and they're talking, there's no question around cognition. But if you have a visual disability and you're in a wheelchair and you don't talk, I feel like presuming potential for learning or competency around things seems to be a huge leap for people. Talk to me a little bit about vision, cognition, and kind of if that has ever come into play for you, who is a physically capable body and verbal. But I know that you've witnessed what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a different aspect of intersectionality, right? Is that we often think about intersectionality in terms of race, gender, and then disability. But even within disability itself, there's intersectionality, right? So there are conditions related to the one that I have where you also lose your hearing. So you lose your vision and your hearing at the same time. And often, I think people presume certain things about like your ability to learn or your cognition. It's often like I've seen it with deaf people, like, let's talk louder at you. It's like, no, you just need to think about how you deliver the information, right? How you present it in different ways, because I practice universal design for learning, right? So thinking about presenting it in different ways, but like just doubling down on like, well, let's just talk louder at you. Or what I've often seen too, and it goes back to that, like the attitude that some people bring, like grab me. So I'm in an environment. Let me, I know you're trying to be helpful, but you'll grab me and take me somewhere. Or I'm using a wheelchair. I'm going to touch your wheelchair and I'm going to move you without first asking you. That's a violation of autonomy, right? Not to mention that, especially if I'm having a bad vision day where I can't really see very well, when you grab me, you disorient me. So just thinking about like etiquette and how we provide assistance and how we assume, what people can do and can't do is really important. So
Yes, I
just
was
having that respect for human dignity is it's at the bottom of it.
right. I was listening to a podcast, and the woman is a reporter, and she was having a personal experience where her mother was starting to have dementia, and she was sharing the experience of taking her mother to the doctor and how just because it says she's starting to have dementia, they started immediately speaking to her daughter, the reporter. And that kind of makes me think about definitely students who we work with who are non-speaking. People talk about them in front of them all the time. I assume that happens with people with other disabilities as well.
Absolutely. And I think to your point about like intersectionality, especially as you get older, right? First of all, I often say that if you're not interested in accessibility, you probably will be someday. So start designing for your future self is what I say, right?
It's true.
So as we go over certain milestones in our life, 50, 60, 70, the incidence of disability goes way up. And not only that, but multiple disabilities. So it could be that you've had a stroke, right? And that impacts all kinds of things. It impacts your memory, might impact your ability to speak. It may also impact your vision and your hearing. So, you have a range of different challenges. And so that's why it's important, like, don't focus on the person, focus on the environment, right?
Good
If we
point.
make the environment more accessible, if we remove barrier, then a whole range of different people can use that environment, regardless of what their challenge is.
Right.
So I think that's when we get overwhelmed, is that we try to like add up the different boxes, right? Like you're a person with a visual impairment and you're a multilingual learner and you use AAC. And
Right.
that's not the way life works. We're kind of like more of a Venn diagram, and
Right.
it's difficult to design something that's gonna. Or it's difficult if you just focus on the person and addressing each specific need, but focus on the environment and make it flexible and make it have those supports in place. And then people will choose which supports work best for them.
Right. And I think too, there's a little bit of first do no harm in this, because it seems like, if we have a child with that's in a wheelchair, that's not non-speaking and that is low vision or blind, and we're moving them around. What there's the benefit of saying, hey, I'm going to push you right, of being very verbal about what's happening and assuming that they have receptive language skills. Because if we're assuming that their cognition is low and they don't have receptive language skills, then we are doing all kinds of things to their bodies without giving them the opportunity to process the language around what's happening. And I think it's like one of those things, like it doesn't hurt anybody in the whole classroom to hear you talk about what you're going to do. It doesn't hurt anybody, but the reverse is not true. So being silent and just assuming that they're not going to be able to understand what's going on is not only detrimental to the person, but to everyone around in which you're modeling the way that we honor them, honor their autonomy, even if they can't move their chair by themselves, even if they can't talk right now, or they don't have a system yet, or whatever. It's like they're still a human being, and they deserve to be communicated with, even if we don't have all the knowledge about everything on their cognition or receptive language skills. It's like the first do no harm thing is like, let's provide it. If you don't need it, great.
And just to go back to something that I said earlier, like when I talked about my experience and how I kind of stumbled into assistive technology and discovered it almost by accident. I don't want that to happen for other people. We can be a little bit more proactive, right? That's leaving it to chance. Like the reason why I got connected with things like the NFB and actually got connected with vocational rehab. And that also changed my life because now it gave me access to a whole bunch of resources that I needed, that I didn't even know existed. And that was through a chance encounter with another blind person on the bus who said, you should contact vocational rehab and get trained on how to
Really?
use a white cane. Yeah. So like we want to be more intentional in terms of like having resources that we can share. Like I'm trying to work with medical professionals whenever I can to just provide them with like, if somebody comes to you and you diagnose them with a visual impairment, here are some support groups. Here are some resources that you can share with them so that again, we're being proactive in how we provide those supports. You don't let people just kind of stumble through life and hey, by chance, if they meet somebody on the bus or
Quite literally, yes.
then they end up where they're supposed to be, right? But we can be more proactive in our school systems, in our places of employment, and being at the ready with those supports to share. You don't have to be an expert in them. You just need to know where to point people.
And I think sharing stories is helpful too, because you hear different things that have worked for them, or did you know about this? And so probably the three of us have, we talked to someone about what we do, and they think, oh, I know someone who benefits from something like that you do, right? Can you tell us a little bit about CAST and how people can find some of the supports that you're talking about?
Yeah, so CAST, it used to stand for the Center for Applied Specialized Technology, but now it's just CAST, in case you're wondering, because I get that question a lot.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it has to do with our history, right? When we started, in fact, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, right? And back when we started, we were developing technologies and interventions for students in special education. We used to call them, like, the students who were in the margins back then, who education was not serving. And so we needed to find some innovative solutions to address their needs. But over time, what the original CAST team found was that what helped those students really helped everybody. So, like text to speech or speech to text, all of those supports or vocabulary lists in digital books, right? Those supports really benefited everybody. So again, we moved to CAST, especially as we developed the Universal Design for Learning principles. So UDL, or Universal Design for Learning, is really based in that idea that the barriers are in the environment, not in people. And to me, that's really empowering because we can redesign the environment and make it more flexible. Flexibility is the name of the game here, right? So we put in different supports, different design features, so that a range of different people can use the environment, as I mentioned earlier. And so we do a number of things. We do research, we do publishing, we provide technical assistance around accessibility, but beyond accessibility, because Universal Design for Learning also involves the social and emotional dimensions of learning, right? We are not just a set of walking brains. We're more than that. We learn in community with others, in communication with others, however that communication looks or sounds or works, right? So thinking about how we support learning from that social and emotional perspective is really important. And then thinking about things like executive functioning and how we support executive functioning so that people can set goals and monitor their progress and the like. So the best place in terms of learning about Universal Design for Learning, CAST.org, CAST.org. And then, if you're really specifically interested in accessibility and accessible educational materials, then I would say AEM.cast.org. AEM stands for Accessible Educational Materials. And like I said, we have a federally funded center, based at CAST, that really focuses on that area of education accessibility.
Yeah, that's so many resources available through CAST, like you mentioned. And if you're listening and you're just starting to dive into this because of a personal experience or professional, it's a really great place to start.
And I'll mention one last resource. I did mention that we publish. So there is a book that I created that's available through the publishing side of CAST, Learning on the Go.
Great.
And it really focuses on how to use mobile technologies for learning. So all of those features that, again, had a big influence, big impact on my life, they're addressed in that book. And so it focuses primarily on the iPad, but there's information in there about Chromebooks and Microsoft devices and more. So check that out. It's Learning on the Go, and it's available through CAST Publishing.
We'll definitely put a link to that. And I will also plug your podcast because I know I've listened to several of them. The last one was an early intervention teacher talking about vision. And it's really helpful podcast, really accessible to a lot of people, I think.
And you'll be interested. Well, number one, we try to model accessibility with our podcast. But number two, this upcoming month, if things work out in terms of scheduling, we're going to be interviewing an AAC user for our podcast. So stay tuned. I think that's going to be really exciting. We're really interested in sharing not just the professional stories, but also the lived experience stories, because, like you said, those are really powerful. in terms of moving people and getting towards action, right? Not just awareness, but action in terms of making changes that really have an impact on students.
That is so exciting because having a mentor that had the same had similar lived experiences was such a big deal. And representation with our AAC population is always challenging. Representation with AAC and low vision is not there yet. People and parents, kids aren't being exposed to those lived experiences. In education, sometimes we separate out to give you a skill, and then there's a like a okay, but I have to work. I have to be around sighted people. Or okay, but I need to, I'm going to live. My family is not deaf. So I need to, move. I need to know how to be around and be educated in general, in, public education. So what are your thoughts on that whole thing?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it a lot because, again, being diagnosed late in life, but
Sure.
I would say to the greatest extent possible, if you can be educated at your school with appropriate braille instruction, that would be ideal because you're part of a community, you have friends. For some people, that may be a great choice, right? Going away and going to a residential school for the blind. You actually may be more included there, believe it or not. Yes, we think about it as being separated, right? But you may be more included if you're around other people that understand your lived experience and have the professional preparation to support you. But at the same time, like that's a personal decision. It should be a personal decision, not one that you're forced to make. So the best approach, I guess, an ideal world is that at our schools, we have Braille instruction, but we also have assistive technology instruction. So that what we're doing is we're giving people a toolkit so that they use those tools when they make sense. Like I actually regret, well, I don't regret it because I didn't really have a choice in it. The fact that I was diagnosed late in life means I don't know Braille. I wish I did because, Braille doesn't require batteries. How many times am I navigating around and my phone is running low on battery? And, and then with signage and things like that, Braille would be incredibly helpful when I travel. So it's all about like building a robust toolkit, but again, giving people like some agency. If you want to stay in your community and you want to continue to participate in other things in your community, have that choice. If you decide that going away to a residential school is the best solution for you and your family, then having that choice as well is important.
I was thinking about how far we've come because I remember working really early in my career and trying to get I think it was like co-writer or something with that was going to have word prediction. And of course we use it all the time now, but back then it was like that's cheating and well if we provide that for them then we're going to have to provide it for everyone and then we'll never know if they know how to spell words. I mean, we accommodations I feel like when they first came out, it was like that's cheating.
It's still very common that myth that this is cheating. But in some ways, if you look at it from a UDL, Universal Design for Learning perspective, it actually increases the rigor of what you're learning because what you're doing when you provide those supports is you remove the unnecessary barriers, right? So that you can really focus on the deeper learning. And it all comes down to what is the goal? So if the goal is like gauging whether you understand the concept, then how you demonstrate that you understand the concept, that's up to you, right? It's still something that we need to address that it's actually not cheating. It's actually a way of just removing unnecessary barriers. So you can really focus your energies on what I call the productive struggle of learning. Like learning is not meant to be easy, right? It's, well, I should say learning is meant to be challenging because in the challenge is where the learning takes place. As you stretch yourself and you reach for something beyond where you are now. But at the same time, we do want to remove the unnecessary barriers.
And you mentioned, Louise, that idea of a toolkit, and we know how important that is, that thinking about students with low vision, how if a vision changes over time, it changes during the day. They have agency to choose when they want to use different tools and depends on the environment that they're in. But you also mentioned that some of those things are available but need to be taught, and there needs to be some instruction about that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And I think that's one of the reasons too why it's important as early as possible to start exposing students to some of these tools, because it takes time to develop your preferences, to develop your proficiency, and also to develop a language around these tools. So that again, when you get to high school, when you get to college, right, when more responsibility for learning it's put on you, like when you get to college, you have to advocate for yourself, which is also like that's a top skill, learning how to self-advocate, right? So I think the earlier that we can expose students to these tools, the better. And like you said, for some of these tools, changing the font, changing the colors, those don't really require that much skill other than like going into the accessibility settings and finding where they are and trying out a few of them until you find the ones that work best for you. But with things like a screen reader, switch access, some of the more advanced features that are built in, that does require often that you have some instruction, and it does take time to build the skill. For me, like when I was learning a screen reader, a lot of it was muscle memory, like learning the shortcuts, and that just takes practice. It takes time. So you can't like wait until high school, and if you can, right? Like if you know as a child, or your family knows as a child, that you have a visual impairment, the earlier you can start on this, the better. So that when you get to high school where the workload goes up, or you get to, in my case, graduate school, where like I don't have the option without a major disruption to my learning to like take a few months and go learn a screen reader. So
So
earlier the better.
it's, I'm reminded of during my kids were in high school during COVID, and so we got them laptops. And then they had to learn how to submit online and do all these things in high school. And so they got into college, and that's how things were already going in college. And it was like, I don't have to learn a new system while I'm learning a new con so much new content. And I mean, that was, I wish I could have said that that was planned, and it wasn't, but it made me run through this. Exactly what you're saying is like, man, we need to start the technology as early as possible before the cognitive demands are so high that you're learning two things. You're learning a new content or new area, and you're learning the technology that's supporting that. That cognitive load is impressive, and not everyone can do that. So yeah, teaching the tools, and by the way, same goes with the family.
And that's what often happens in college, why a number of students with like disabilities, they sometimes drop out. It's not that they can't handle the content, it's the time demands, right? Like the content goes way up from what they expected when they were in high school. And then on top of that, you have to manage scheduling a whole bunch of other things, right? Like your tutors, or you work with the disability services office, and maybe if you're just learning how to use the assistive technology, you have to juggle that as well. And the same thing goes for testing, right? Like if you don't teach the use, even if you are not allowed to have, which that's a different conversation, right? Being allowed to use the accommodations during the test. But if you're not using those tools throughout the year in your instruction, and then when you get to the test, that's the first time you see them, and you that's
I
not going to be
remember them
good.
going, oh, state testing's in a month. What are we doing for these kids? I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, that should have been a consideration all along, because not only for the testing purposes, like that you'll have a better testing experience if you're more comfortable with the tools, but how about all the learning that leads to that test?
And
sometimes we'll see in schools that the educators said, well, we gave them this assistive technology, but they didn't use it, or they used it a little bit, but so what can we do? They're not using it. And I think it just goes back to also that instruction piece, and that there's variability in what they may use.
Yeah, I would highly recommend checking out the new AT guidance from the US Department of Education as well, because it's going to address a number of questions that have come up here, like, is it cheating? Those kinds of questions, and the fact that just dropping the technology on somebody's lap without the support, not only for the student, like you mentioned, but for the family, Like this all works as a system, right? And so we have to take a holistic approach to it. So I'd highly recommend checking out that new AT guidance because it really breaks things down in a easily digestible way. That's really easy to understand.
Yeah, the myths and facts. I love.
On a different note, but similar, is like I remember working with a student with dyslexia, and it wasn't that the supports didn't help, it's that he had did not want to look different, be different, be have different supports. He didn't want to highlight his disability, is kind of how he's feeling. And the thing is it was like, you get to feel like that. Like, this is like emotional for you to realize that in order for you to be successful, you might need these tools, and these tools feel like they're highlighting your disability, or these tools feel like they're isolating you because you need extra time, you have to go. And I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that in all of our efforts, that there's an emotional piece to all of this.
Well, and I saw that firsthand with a white cane. That was a process, and it was exactly what you just described, was like not wanting to stand out. And so the way that we, again, going back to universal design for learning and how we redesign the environment, what if we made text-to-speech available to everybody, right? And now it's not something that is specific to one person, at least that's a baseline, right? We could provide more advanced text-to-speech solutions to those who need more intensive use of them. But if we make it available for everybody, then it removes some of that stigma. And we saw that with the iPad, right? When it came out, how all of a sudden it's a consumer device. It's the same device you can go to the store and purchase. And so that had a big impact in adoption and making it popular with families and with
And
kids.
in
So
AAC world for sure.
yeah,
And you told the funniest story about your cane to me. And so I think you're a professor or something. You were teaching a class. Do you remember the story?
Is it the metal detector story?
No, but I do want to hear that one. It was that you taught the first certain amount of the class.
So I taught a class, and it had to do, it's in the disability studies program, which a lot of my work also comes from that perspective. So I thought it'd be interesting to teach the first 4 weeks of the class as well as I could without revealing that I was a person with a disability. And then on like week five, I would come in with my cane and just walk through the door, and then the students would just be like their brain couldn't comprehend what was going on. And so that led to a really good conversation about how like some of these indicators of disability, like there's certain attitudes that get activated and so on, certain assumptions that we need to sort of be on the lookout and continue to challenge those assumptions. So that's just an exercise that I did for my students, but I think it was kind of helpful in confronting them with ableist attitudes. But I very briefly, I'll tell you the metal detector
Yes,
story,
please.
is that I was at Busch Gardens, which is an amusement park here where I live in Florida. And I was walking around with my cane, and this child comes up to me, and he asks his mom, or he actually asked me, "Hey, mister, is that a metal detector?" And I basically answered to him what it was, right? But I actually applauded him for, first of all, asking me. And sometimes that's the way that we clear up some of these misconceptions, right? By not asking the story, or by mom saying, "Hey, don't look at that person, shy away from that person," that's a message in itself. Like, disability is something to be avoided, to not talk about.
Pretend it doesn't exist.
I actually welcomed it. It was a really positive interaction that the child felt comfortable in asking me, and I was able to explain to them what the white cane was and how we should never grab it, or just like we wouldn't grab or touch a guide dog. So again, it's sometimes by being vulnerable and being willing to ask questions that we have those breakthrough moments where we challenge these assumptions. So anyway, that was the
Yes, that's a great
metal
story.
detector story.
No, but parents will say that, like, in preschool, kids would just come up and say, "What's wrong with him?" And then you tell them, and they'd be like, "Oh, does he play this, or does he want to do that?" Like, it's done. And then as kids get older, they have been conditioned not to ask, not to question, not to stare, not to do these kinds of things. And there's actually a disconnect. It's like, I don't know, there's now they have some sensors around what
Right.
they're brave enough to ask about. And it actually becomes the barrier in making friends because they don't want to offend. They don't want to do these different things. So I think if we could all be a little childlike and just being respectfully inquisitive of how can I learn more
Yeah,
about
absolutely.
you, that would go a long ways.
And by the way, I'm not getting emotional. You may see tears. It's just my eyes do get tired. When they do get tired, then I start to tear up. And so I am an emotional person. Everybody who knows me, I do let my emotions out very easily. But right now it's not
All right. We haven't hit on
emotions.
that for you today. Well, hey, we're going to need to wrap up in a minute, but I did want to ask, in universities, this is where you experienced your diagnosis and you probably the first time that you needed to start advocating for yourself in a way that you knew what you were advocating for your vision specifically. Do all universities now have a service or a place where students can get assistive technology and tools?
Many of them do. It's often through, there's an Office of Disability Services. It may go by different names. So what I would say to a student who's in high school is try to visit the universities that you're interested in. And that's one of the questions that you should ask is what central location can I go to get help with acquiring the materials that I need? I would also say look into services. I haven't mentioned it much in this episode, but one of the life-changing tools is Bookshare. To this day, I'm a Bookshare user. Like I pay for it even as an adult. But if you're in education, you can get it for free if you have a qualifying disability. So they can help you with things like that, getting you connected to things like Bookshare. And sometimes there may be like in my university, we had a center on campus that focused on instructional technology. And so we did a lot of that work as well. But typically it's a disability services office that you would reach out to through student services.
Great, thank you. And Bookshare is online accessible books.
Yeah, in a range of formats, you can download them in EPUB, which is again a really flexible format where you can change the appearance. You can use text-to-speech. You can use a screen reader. There's Braille content as well, so you can download it as digital Braille and use it with Braille displays and much more. And it's fairly easy to qualify. You just go on their website, look up what the qualification criteria are. But like I said, even after I was no longer a student, I find it so valuable that it's the first place that I go to look. If there's a book that I want to read, I'll go on there and look for it first before I buy it. Learning Ally is the other one. That's another one that it's available, right? But I found in higher ed, Bookshare was the one that had most of the content that I was looking for. So
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's just been really a pleasure to talk with you about your own personal experiences and about the support that CAST has to offer.
I really appreciate you being on here too. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. If there's any way that I can help, please reach out. And again, check out our resources on the CAST website. They're there for you to help you make this process easier as for people as they need these supports.
Wonderful.
Great. Thank you.
The contents of this podcast were developed under contract with the Washington Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, U.S. Department of Education, and administered by Central Washington University. However, those contents did not necessarily represent the policy of the OSPI and CWU, and you should not assume endorsement by the federal and state government.